WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. David Mamet's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Glengarry Glen Ross, was adapted for the screen in 1992. Mamet wrote the screenplay, and James Foley directed the movie. It's taken 10 years for that film to be released on DVD, but it's been worth the wait. Glengarry Glen Ross is about a group of men selling bad real estate to broke customers. These guys are very persuasive and persistent, with a bag of verbal tricks to get customers to buy. They also use their techniques on their boss and on each other to try to get the best customers or the best leads. It's a perfect story for Mamet, who has a great ear for the everyday music of colloquial speech. The film is loaded with wonderful actors, including Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Ed Harris, Alan Arkin, and Alec Baldwin. In this scene, Baldwin plays the no-nonsense boss from company headquarters sent down to chew out the sales team and frighten them into getting fast results.
Put that coffee down. Coffee's for closers only. You think I'm f***ing with you? I am not f***ing with you. I'm here from downtown. I'm here from Mitch and Murray. And I'm here on a mission of mercy. Your name's Levine.
Yeah.
You call yourself a salesman, you son of a b-? I don't gotta listen to this sh-. You certainly don't, pal. Because the good news is you're fired. The bad news is you've got all you've got just 1 week to regain your job, starting with tonight. Starting with tonight's sit. Oh, have I got your attention now? Good. Because we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest. As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize is a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired.
James Foley also directed the thrillers At Close Range and After Dark, My Sweet. Terry Gross spoke with Foley in 1992 in front of an audience who had just seen a screening of Glengarry Glen Ross.
When you're directing a movie in which all the actors in it are playing the part of somebody who's very aggressive and in selling, are they that way when you're trying to direct them? Was it intimidating at all because they're all playing these really manipulative people who have their raps and they have their ways?
No, it was, which has been my experience really on every film, that actors really, really want to be directed and they want interaction.
Even the big stars?
Oh, well, that's what's great. Is that, you know, doesn't matter who it is, you know, they just, and I really think the best actors, I mean, you know, like Al and the rest of the guys, are so interested in trying anything that they very much want a reaction. And what was interesting, as you said before, is that each person wants that reaction in a different way. I mean, some people don't want you to say certain things, and the people do want you to say certain things. And that's the fun part, is this instinctual idea of figuring out what it is that they need at what time, including sometimes being a little bit pushing a little bit more than they might want at the time. But there's a mutual understanding of what you're doing.
Who did you push?
Oh, I pushed them all at different times in different ways, you know, but it's just, it's all different how you push them. Because sometimes pushing just means, let's do another take right now, really fast. And they go, well, wait. And you say, no, it has to be really fast because, you know, we're really in, and you sort of discombobulate them on purpose because you feel like perhaps we're getting into a kind of a rut and it's getting too precious and people are getting too conscious of what they're saying and you want to. And I've taken to do weird things like, you know, I demand silence all the time from everybody on the crew and everything. And I'm always barking about that. And then I get total silence. And then when it's ready to go, I scream, action, like as loud as I can, which is like really startling. And then the actor's got to be start saying his line. But it's sort of like sometimes you see them standing there and they're getting too much into a plan of what they're going to do. And you want them to forget their plan and let whatever happens going to happen. And so it's all different things of doing. I actually threw a fit once, a fake fit, yelling at somebody on the crew just to, you know, get the actors out of their lethargy and change the mood, the electricity on the set.
Was the crew member in on the fact that this was a fake fit?
Yes. Yes, I made sure I did that.
So what were you throwing the fit about?
I was throwing the fit about people talking, because I'm famous for throwing fits, real fits, because people will not shut up. So I asked this one guy to talk, right, so then I could turn around and scream at him.
The casting is terrific in the film, but it seems to me you've brought together actors with really different kinds of acting styles. You have Jack Lemmon, who's a kind of like naturalistic actor. And Al Pacino's Al Pacino,
I was going to sit and wait until you get an adjective for each guy.
Yeah. But Ed Harris is kind of chameleon-like in a way, and he can really like blend into a role. But they're, I don't know, like Lemmon's of a different generation than a lot of actors in there, both in terms of his age, but also in terms of his style. And I was wondering if you consciously picked people with different acting styles and what it was like to work with people who, it seems to me, probably take really different approaches to their characters.
Yeah, there was certainly no intention to deliberately pick people with different styles. It was really, I mean, Al and I literally sat down and made a list of who we thought were the best living actors, without even regards to what parts they could play, how old they were. Who do we think is great? And the list isn't that long, you know, when you sit down and just say who's the best. And we started from that idea and wound up with these guys. And it's very true that they all have very different styles of acting. And it was a great fun for me when, particularly when they were all in the scene together. And, you know, you say cut, and then you need to go out and speak to each one of them. And I'd find myself instinctually sort of speaking an entirely different language to each one, which was nice, because it made me sort of really expand my own idea of what it means to be a director. And, you know, for me, the most important thing is to do what needs to be done rather than what you want to do.
So you needed to speak a different language to each of the actors?
Totally, yes.
Okay, and so what would you tell Jack Lemmon as opposed to Al Pacino, as opposed to Ed Harris?
Jack Lemmon will speak very clearly about the thing, quite literally. The thing being what's going on at the moment that, and perhaps the most telling thing is that when Jack would talk about the character, he would say, he would say, I think he's feeling this because of this and blah, 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 and say whole articulate sentences. Al would never speak like that, because first of all, he would say, I, referring to something, but he would never talk about any kind of singular idea or notion. And something that I understand very much, because if you articulate a single idea that's happening, then you might try, you know, you might sort of glom onto that in too much of a specific way rather than letting all the contradictions and ambivalences that might naturally come out. So he's very reluctant to identify any one particular feeling, and even reluctant to finish a sentence. But I began to understand very well what he was talking about, and I agreed with him. So our communication was more like him saying, I think, you know, maybe, you know, and I'd say, yeah, right, more so, blah, blah, blah. And we somehow did it, and even to the point where it got to, you know, where once we had done enough takes where we both felt like we really had it, we would always do one crazy one. And that's, we would just call it a crazy one, because to try something just that was a stupid idea, but it's amazing how many of the crazy ones are in there.
Director James Foley, speaking with Terry Gross in 1992. His film Glengarry Glen Ross has just been released on DVD. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with director James Foley. His 1992 film Glengarry Glen Ross has just come out on DVD. Let's hear another scene from the film. Al Pacino plays Ricky Roma, a self-assured, charismatic salesman and the only one of the group who is consistently closing deals and making money. In this scene, he's working a potential customer and won't let go.
You know, they say you don't buy it, you rent it.
Huh?
The thing. You really, what do you keep? I mean, you don't keep anything, really.
No.
Security. Things. Things. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you try to stave off insecurity You can't do it.
No.
No, that's what I'm telling you. Stocks, bonds, objects of art, real estate. What are they? An opportunity. To what? To make money? Perhaps. To lose money? Perhaps. To indulge and to learn about ourselves? Perhaps. So what? What isn't? They're an opportunity. That's all they are. They're an event. A guy comes to you, you make a call, you send in a card. I have these properties I would like for you to see. What does this mean? What do you want it to mean? You see what I'm saying? Things happen to you. Glad I met you. I'm glad I met you, James. I want to show you something. It may mean something to you. It may not. I don't know. I don't know anymore. What is that? Florida. Glengarry Highlands. Florida. Bullshit. And maybe that's true. And that's what I said. But look at this. What is this? This is a piece of land. Listen to what I'm going to tell you now.
When you were rehearsing for this, did you bring in any real salesmen to give a sense of how they do it, to talk about their spiels?
Yeah, we did. Somehow somebody dug up a real guy who came in, who was great. He read the script and was thrilled by it and was very proud that we were making a film about him. And he really was very, he was a good sort of visitor because he thought it was very authentic down to every detail, and that gave everybody encouragement. What was interesting about him was that he had no consciousness whatsoever that there was any irony about the situation. He just thought it was a very good story about these guys and showed how sort of clever they were and stuff like that. And he thought it was quite glamorous. And that was very good because the guys at this point during the rehearsals really needed to connect to that, you know, because they needed to, of course, you know, not see anything ironic about it themselves and, you know, let that take care of it and had to become totally and find some pride in being one of these guys because, you know, they all are, particularly Ricky Roma being the top of the heap. You know, he was very proud, Al, of his pinky ring. He was always looking at it and happy with his suit that cost $2,000. And he would, like, you know, like he does, get into it.
So what did this guy sell who you brought in, and why did you bring him in?
To be honest, I don't know where what rock people found him under, but I know he was real because when I sort of teased him a little bit about perhaps he was, you know, involved in something like, you know, quasi-illegal about maybe what he did in misrepresenting the land, because he had brought himself right up to that point in sort of showing off about how he had really, you know, scammed people and got people to pay much more than the market value of what he was selling. But when I sort of teased him about it, he then got kind of a little bit weird and defensive because all of a sudden he sort of came back to reality and realized that he was feeling very comfortable because the guys were all sort of around him and sort of giving him, and his big movie stars were paying attention to this guy. So he was like saying more than he wanted to, and then all of a sudden he realized how far he was going and he backed up.
So was it useful to have him there?
Yeah, yeah. I think very much. I think if nothing else, to see that a real person existed and that he was, as I say, that he had a sense of real pride in himself.
I wonder if, like, getting assigned to or volunteering to make a movie that you don't really believe in would be the equivalent of what these guys are up against, selling stuff that isn't good.
That's very interesting. I think exactly that. I have thought about that because I had one experience where I did that. And it was hell. I directed an episode of Twin Peaks, and it was in the second season. And they asked me in the first season, and I couldn't do it. So they asked me at the beginning of the second season, and I said yes, and I made this commitment, and thinking it would be like the first season. By the time I got there, David Lynch had totally abandoned the thing. The scripts, he was not putting input into the writing of the script. He was off in Tokyo selling his art. And there I was stuck with this script that had nothing, that was like faux Lynch, you know, it was like a bunch, a bunch of people sitting around sort of making believe they were David Lynch, and I'm stuck with this script, and it was horrifying. Nothing was more terrible in my life, because you don't know what to do. I don't know where to put the camera. I don't know what to say to the actors. I just want to go home. And it was really, really an awful experience. Luckily, it was only 4 or 5 days, you know, one episode. But it gave me a lesson about that very thing, that there's no way I could get through making a film that I didn't, even if delusional, didn't think had the potential to be good.
Director James Foley speaking in 1992 with Terry Gross about Twin Peaks and about his film Glengarry Glen Ross.